This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jim Blair, Chair of the University Assembly. I have 4:31, and I'm calling this meeting of the University Assembly to order. First item up is late additions to the agenda. I know we have one, Mr. Battaglia.
I'd like to submit Resolution 7 for your consideration. This is a resolution I'm sponsoring entitled Calling for the Implementation of an Open Course Evaluation. It will be handled at the end of this meeting.
Are there any objections to adding Resolution 7 for introduction to the end of the agenda? Hearing none, it is added. Are there other late additions to the agenda? Hearing none, we move to the minutes of February 24th, 2015. These were circulated to members prior to the meeting. Are there any additions or changes to the minutes? Professor Hatch.
Yes, I'd like a letter mentioned by Matt from MacArthur Lee. I would like that letter to be entered as a part of the minutes, as well as 157 signatures.
So in section 4, Executive Committee, second sentence, to now read, Matthew Battaglia reported that the UA received a letter with 157 signatures from Catherine Lee, class of 2015, requesting UA support for divestment, and we were requesting the letter to be attached to the minutes. Are there any other changes to the minutes? Hearing none, I ask unanimous consent to approve the minutes as amended. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the minutes are amended and approved. Next is Executive Committee and Constituent Assembly updates facilitated by the Vice Chair, Mr. Battaglia.
Thank you, Chairman Blair. I'm happy to report that the JCC Selection Committee has put forth a nomination for the annual year 2016 Judicial Code Counselor. Adebola Afumi Michael Oliphant has been nominated to serve as the Judicial Code Counselor. His nomination will be brought before this Assembly for its approval on March 24th, as has been past practice. Furthermore, I'd like to make members aware that we have a resolution regarding divestment. It'll be UA Resolution Number 6, divestment from companies producing fossil fuels and holding fossil fuel reserves, that will be brought before this Assembly on March 24th with a vote at the earliest scheduled for April 7th. I then recognize the chair for one further announcement.
We'd like to welcome the at-large seats for next year's UA. There are four at-large candidates at the moment. Justin Cray, Matthew, is it Indimi? I'm sorry?
Indimini.
And Eduardo Medina, correct? And then Matthew Battaglia, welcome. They're here to see what we do. And afterwards, or at the very end of the meeting, we'll ask them to introduce themselves a little more formally. And at the conclusion of the meeting, I'll answer any questions they may have, or actually probably take down notes of all the things that they recommend we do better. But welcome. We're glad that you were with us. Let me clarify the JCC action was actually Mr. Oliphant was appointed by President Scorton, and our role is in confirmation at March 24th.
Are there any other assemblies that have any business that is of importance to report to the University Assembly?
Then hearing none, we'll move on to business of the day. First up is the annual update from the Judicial Administrator. The Chair would like to welcome Mary Beth Grant back to the Assembly. Mary Beth is the University Judicial Administrator, and we are recognizing you for 20 minutes.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate your flexibility in letting me go first. I do have a firm deadline at 5 o'clock, so I just set my clock. So what I plan to do, I have a list of questions from Jim. And Jim, did others get the list of questions?
Yes, they did, and they're also in your read-ahead package.
Excellent. So what I'm going to do, you've all gotten a copy of the report. You've all gotten a copy of the list of questions asking for clarification. And what I'm going to do is just talk. I'm going to just go through the list of questions. I think that it's best for me to focus on what's really in your mind. I'll speak for 10 minutes, and then if it seems like, oh, heck, we're not going to get through all these questions, then just start figuring out which questions we haven't hit yet that we really need to make sure we address. And then I haven't addressed 5-5, when my alarm goes off, I'll follow up with him writing. Sound like a good plan? Okay. I also had a thought, and I don't know if you want me to address it here, but I emailed this to Randy with respect to some of the initiatives going on for the SA and the JCC regarding the consolidation of things. And I had a thought about that. I don't know if you want me to talk about that or just focus on
it. It's up to you. The annual update and the report are preeminent on our minds, but other things that you think we need to know, please bring them forward.
So I guess the only thing I'll just say about that is this policy notebook from 2005-2006 is essentially that consolidation of types of codes that the folks have been talking about. And that was done, I think the 2005-2006 may have been the last one published until 2008, it was still good up till then, and then they went to an online version. I checked in with colleagues at Residential Programs to find out what's currently being done to get the different information to students, and they are being provided links to policies through communication to the dean's student's office. So, Amanda, I actually brought this for you and Emily to have this as an extra copy, so if you guys want to keep it, I'll just leave it here for you. But I think it's the more notice, the better for students, so if there are ways that folks can improve the notification for students, great. But I think that from a conservation and sustainability perspective, yes, we are getting away from written documents like this, and we should think about ways to consolidate it online. And I think it's already being done, but maybe it needs to be done in ways that more people are aware of. All right. So going through the list of questions, what are the Group J's biggest successes over the last year? I would take far too much time to look at all of our successes. But the thing that we spent the most time on, the thing that really requires most of our attention, was changing the policy, the way, the procedures that we were using for sexual assault cases, sexual assault and sexual harassment cases, switching to policy 6.4, as you know. One of the biggest surprises to us is that it takes a lot longer than we thought it would. Not the investigation part. The investigation part is substantially the same as the investigation that that my colleagues and I have been doing for, you know, over 15 years. But the change of having every single case going before a panel, every single case having a detailed report, every single case having the opportunity for people to do things in writing, with a lot of timelines built in for that, rather than most cases in the past being resolved by agreement or a hearing that would take maybe a couple of nights but not take as long as an investigative report. That was a big surprise to us. Overall, I think that the process is working from the perspective of making sure that all parties' voices are heard, that all parties are getting fair treatment and being treated respectfully and treated having fair and equal rights under the process. I think that we made some changes to the process. This is going right into the next question. We made some changes in the way that we're implementing the process this year, not required by policy at the time, they're going to be in the future, but trying to increase both reality but also the perception of fairness. So, for example, one of the things that we got feedback from the review panel is that they felt they needed more information about the underlying evidence. Instead of summarizing the evidence the way that it was done in the other office that handled these types of cases, the Office of Workforce Policy and Labor Relations, they really wanted to see the summary of our notes. They really wanted to see the action for Facebook messages. Fine with us. Now, this year, we are providing an entire appendix, sometimes 100 or 200 pages, of every piece of evidence that the JA's office has considered. I think that that means they're really hearing the voice and not a review panel. Fine. You know, down the road, we might need to change some of the language around that. But we're getting positive feedback from the review panel members that that's more comfortable to them when they're being asked to make these, you know, very difficult decisions. They wanted more information. So it's now a difference in the way that cases against students are being handled compared to the way staff and faculty I think another challenge has been, and we talked about this for this body before, the statute of limitations. We continue, I continue to believe that the statute of limitations should be either longer or absent. If somebody doesn't bring a case forward in a timely manner, the case is going to be harder to investigate in general, regardless of from a complaint point of view or from a respondent point of view. But because trauma can impact the way that somebody wants to proceed and the notion of change over time, I think that not having statute of limitations is appropriate, at least to open up the possibility of an investigation. Understanding that many investigations that are opened after a certain period of time will mean that respondents have graduated, cases won't be proved, evidence won't have been preserved, memories will fade. Understanding that there may be a difference in the way the investigation could have proceeded, but still giving that opportunity to potential complainants. Another challenge that I've identified, I have to say that Joe Burns has been amazing. In recruiting faculty members to serve on these panels. I've sent another list of about 12 more people. So we have now about 24 review panel members to split up this challenging work of reviewing each of these cases. And that's very easy. It's still a challenge to get to show up at the same time for training because they're obviously very busy. So the extra effort for me to make sure that folks are trained in or for my colleagues who are helping with the training. But the other issue is that, and I mean no disrespect to faculty members, but sometimes faculty members are a little bit more removed from the social scene for students. So I've had some faculty members express surprise that, you know, students drink or have sex or smoke weed. And, you know, somebody from student services would already know that. So I think that there could be maybe a change in the panel so that it's not all faculty members, so that the people in the student services side might have a more diverse understanding about the student life. So I hope that this is I don't mean it that way at all. I've been really impressed with the hard work that folks are doing. I also have been contemplating whether it makes sense to have at least one person on each panel who has some sort of legal background, maybe an attorney or maybe not, but somebody who has a really strong sense of what a fair process should be or might be able to compare to due processes. I'm avoiding the word due process because if you guys know that constitutional concept that's not appropriate in an educational setting. But that sense of fairness, to make sure that fairness, that there's fairness all around, and has a really good sense of the difference of standards of proof. You know, what does preponderance of the evidence look like compared to beyond a reasonable doubt? I think that's intuitive to some folks and not intuitive to other folks. And if we make sure that each panel had one person who could sort of be that legal expert, that might be helpful. And it might be helpful to have somebody at each panel who has some expertise about sexual violence in general. What I've been discovering, I've been in this field for, well, at JA for 15 and a half years, but prior to this work, gosh, the 90s or 80s, and it really depends on what you count as having experience in the world of intimate partner violence and sexual assault. You know, one way of counting, I had experience since the 70s. So you forget that some of the things that you know are not intuitive in society in general, or to people who haven't been working and studying in the area for a long time. So I wonder if it would be helpful, in addition to the training that everyone gets, to have someone who's really an expert in that area. And I don't know. I think it's something that we should look at. And, you know, I think that the Title IX coordinating group will take that up. So that is the biggest issue that I would say. There's a question about whether or not all of the investigators are women. Before I answer that question, I think we need to take a step back and think about two different reasons why that question might be raised. One reason might be the comfort of the party, and one reason might be the perception of bias of having one gender over another gender. With respect to the second part of the question, I think we have to tread lightly on that because it makes a bunch of assumptions that somebody cannot be fair unless they match the particular race, gender, religion, and that would really open us up to criticism.
I think the context of that was a little more nuanced than just women versus men. But if there were men in your office, I assume that at some point the panels, your colleagues, talk to each other about certain things and can ask questions to each other about certain things. And so if there is, if it's all women or all men, that traditionally there's a certain perception, if not actuality. And if you have some level of balance there, then in your inner office dynamics and case reviews and all that other stuff, these kinds of things can't come up, and it's probably far more perception than reality. But yeah, there's a fear factor out there.
Sure. So to address that, though, I've actually spoken with Lynette Chappell-Williams about this more generally in this particular issue. When we had a complainant who specifically asked for a female investigator, and that no males be involved in the process, and I didn't think that was a fair request. But I wanted to speak to our equality office. And Lynette agreed with me because she said, we start doing that, most of our people who are accused, our most of our respondents, are white men. Are we all of a sudden going to say we will never have a black investigator? Are we all of a sudden going to say that we can't have a gay investigator? So I think that what we need to make sure of is that whoever it is in the position of investigator, that person has the capability of being fair and listening to both sides, and has the ability to ask questions of campus partners when there's something related to either bias or something about who we are. So for example, if we were to have a case and we had two female investigators on it, and the issue,
We're probably going to run out of time. I think the desire of the assembly, we want everybody. People should be able to pick their panel, but I think they would hope your office is appropriately diverse, age, gender, race, so that there are people in there who can, as you said, like you were talking about the faculty, value all the kinds of things that your office sees, and can talk particulars among themselves. Whereas other, it's inappropriate for outsiders to necessarily engage on any specific cases with that.
And that's the goal for all of us on campus. And I think all of us need to take very seriously the issues of inclusion and diversity, and that's something that we take very seriously. So as you saw in the report, one of the things that we've done that's over and above what's called for in the policy is that we have a second investigator. And to the extent possible, we try to mix the genders so that we have one person who's the investigator of one gender and another person who a different gender with the being the co-investigator. We did have a situation last year and currently going on where our male investigator resigned first from the court cases and then resigned from the office all together. So our lead investigators since September have been exclusively female, and we've had a mix of co-investigators who've been male or female. But I'm absolutely on board with diversity. But I think it's a mistake to say that it will always happen. We can't require it. So it's one of the things that we are aware of and take seriously. But I think you need to tread lightly on those types of questions. Required training and credentials. The training credentials are not specifically laid out in the federal requirements. The folks in my office receive both national training and training internally from people who are our colleagues, like at the Cornell Police Academy, and myself from counsel's office. So we use both internal and external sources for the training. the timelines, we're not meeting the timelines. They already identified that this is something that's a very big concern for us. Some of the extra steps that we're taking to provide a fair process and really make sure that the parties have the ability throughout the process to respond to evidence, to think about things, provide information both orally and in writing, it takes time, and we do it several times throughout the process, and it's adding more time. We have opted in a conscious way that we're still trying to streamline the process and still trying to get the timeline more in line with what the feds are saying. But as we evaluate the value of a speedy process versus a thorough process, we're opting for thorough. So we might get sued on this. You know, it's something easy for the feds to hold us in violation of, but it's a conscious decision of where we're wanting to be more thorough. With respect to serious physical complaints by the academic year referral, folks are concerned about the number of temporary suspensions on merits and expulsions because of the increase. We were too. It was a really hard year. We had a lot of serious cases. That does not reflect any different processes or ways that the Office of the Judicial Administrator was handling cases. It reflects some really hard cases. Someone caught a police officer and grabbed his gun. Somebody else choked his friend so much that the friend passed out. Somebody else threw her friend into the pavement and gave her a concussion. Somebody else pummeled his roommate into having a concussion. Somebody else, it was just really serious. There was one case where we imposed temporary suspensions and then withdrew them within 24 hours because we realized that some of the information that was initially available was inaccurate. And so it demonstrates the flexibility of the use of temporary suspensions when information is not as accurate as was initially seen. And that's the situation where there was a fire started in one of the residence halls, and it initially seemed like it was caused by the residents, but it later was determined that there was an electrical issue with an appliance, and it wasn't really their fault, and we were able to quickly correct that. So that leads us to the question of temporary suspension. The guidelines in the Campus Code of Conduct are very clear about temporary suspensions. There are two requirements. One, and I'm paraphrasing, the conduct has to be really bad, and two, there has to be an impact on the community. What has tended to be, this was not something that was used very much prior to 2001. Spring of 2001, there was a case where a student introduced a weapon into a fight, and that was the first time I used it. In 1998, Barb Krause used it when a student stole ketamine out of the best school library. We made a conscious decision at the time in 2001 to look more closely, more seriously at cases with weapons and other serious cases, including sexual assault, because it seemed like one of the criticisms of the campus disciplinary system was that things were so slow on these really serious cases. Since then, we can see in the stats that we provided in the report, there have been a couple every year. Last year was an anomaly that there were so many. This year there hadn't been as many. One of the things that we are processing and trying to come up with better ways to think about and analyze are the cases with respect to the sexual assault cases. The bottom line is that the review panels are analyzing the cases differently from the way that the hearing board analyzed them in the past. In cases in which we impose sexual temporary suspensions and sexual assault cases, this year have not, under the same analysis that we would have imposed them in under the code, are not being upheld by the review panel. I get that there are two different processes, and I get that the review panels have the ability to make whatever decisions, they each individually feel is appropriate. I worry about it from a university perspective if cases that are primarily being brought with violence against women are being treated less seriously overall than cases that are primarily cases of violence against men. Something that we should think about. Alcohol and drug cases, yeah, more people are smoking weed.
Yes, they are.
I don't know what the national trends are, and yes, we are continuing to work with Gannett, the SAS, and Cornell Police. We've got lots of stuff going on to work overall on alcohol and drug issues, and that will continue. The numbers are frozen up increasing over time. The addition of work required about 6 months overall initial processing time, meaning how long it takes to complete the process from time the situation starts to the JAA until the issue is fully adjudicated, close, increase in stable or decrease in cost of property staff. No, we're not properly staffed. We are, and no one at Cornell is. Let me face it, we're all operating with a 10% less staff than we were a couple of years ago. So, yeah, we're struggling with that. We've taken a lot of measures to be more efficient without more people, and that will continue. It means that we have to prioritize things differently. It means that there's less attention to cases that are more minor, and I think I go into this in the report. I forgot to stop to ask you guys for the direction on where you want to continue. Yeah, Randy.
From your perspective, what would be your prediction of an outcome of the case? How does the preponderance of the evidence change things compared to clear convincing evidence?
Change things in a couple of ways. I think that we've seen more people be willing to come forward with allegations. We've definitely seen an increase in the number of allegations. We've seen more cases come forward that are sort of stereotypically more challenging. We've seen more cases where it's not just that it's an acquaintance, but it's within a relationship. Maybe 10 minutes ago there was consensual sex, and then there is an allegation of rape for the second act of some type of intimacy. So we're seeing more cases. So it doesn't necessarily mean that more cases are being, that people are being found accountable in more cases. There still needs to be a thorough investigation. So it's hard to predict an outcome. But the preponderance of the evidence standard has definitely, when under the code, it led to more agreement. I think that people were more interested, the respondents were more interested in trying to settle matters. But you know, these cases are still very challenging to make sure that all things are being taken into consideration. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So if your question is, are now all respondents found in violation, the answer is no.
Mr. Bataglia.
Just getting back to the issue of temporary suspensions, I'm just curious. I know that a temporary suspension, especially if you're on campus, is akin to a temporary expulsion. You're banned from facilities, you're barred from your meal plan, your email, down the blackboard even. My question is, what kind of oversight is there, and what's the duration generally? Because, for instance, I mean, if you're a senior who's living in College Town, the effect on you is not going to be so great as you're a freshman without a car who's on North Campus. You're both removed from campus, but in one case you have nowhere to go, and your options are much more limited, and in some cases even more urgent than if you can go to a residence that's off campus. So my question really is, what is the duration generally, and then really, is there oversight? Because you said, everyone knows, everyone's understaffed, but if mistakes happen, my concern is what happens to someone, if it takes them a week to get someone interviewed, there could be a lot of harm that's caused in that time.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. So, two things about it. It's not akin to expulsion, because expulsion means that you can never be part of Cornell's campus.
I'm sorry, I meant a temporary expulsion.
Temporary suspension.
Yeah.
So, suspension means that we would expect at some point that you can come back.
Correct.
So, but all those other things are true. You're off campus, you cannot come on campus, you have a persona non grata. If you came on campus, you would be trespassed, or would be a ticket for trespass. So all those things are true now. And the length of time depends on the individual. So there's always oversight available, but it's triggered by the respondent or the accused person making a request for a review. So under the campus code of conduct, that review is conducted by the hearing board, the university hearing board, and it occurs within 5 days of when the petition is filed for for that agenda. So we do it very fast. You know, the petition is filed, then I would do a response. Somebody in my office would do a response. The respondent would have a chance to do a reply, and then it goes to the panel. And that all happens within 5 days. For the 6.4 process, they're not specific about how long it's supposed to take, but we use that 5 days. And again, it's triggered by a receipt of the petition from the respondent. They don't have as many procedures, so, you know, we're relying on sort of the precedent in the office in general of the back and forth and making sure. And both of those processes, incidentally, are in writing. Neither one of them require oral arguments.
So Mary Beth, I know you need to go just about now. If you can answer very quickly, are the transcription summaries and other records required by the code, are those updated or getting up to date?
Oh, they're getting up to date. We're behind.
Okay.
We're working on it. You know.
Do you have an estimated completion date when things will be mainly caught back up?
That's one of the things that falls by the wayside. There's a lot of paperwork that falls by the wayside when we're working on these more serious cases. But I will say that when we know that there's a case that is before us and that there's a case that hearing that's gone before the board that would be part of the public record, we alert the parties to it, that we just had the case and tried to expedite that creation of the case because we want to make sure that we're fair and transparent. And we trust the whoever the responding party is to isolate which cases might be helpful. I mean, we don't want to do their research for them. We try to narrow it down as much as possible.
Thank you. If there's a few of these questions that we didn't get to, if you could send us an email, we'd appreciate that. And if there's any questions, other questions from members, we'll do an e-dialogue.
I don't understand this question, though.
Which one?
The one that the fundamentally inadequate report may not be able or appropriate to provide level of detail desired by a professional user. However, it is very important to VUA that if didactic details. Okay.
It's related to the above. Are you and the JCC making sure the JCC has access to what they need to properly understand, defend, and understand trends and historical precedents and all of that kind of stuff?
We've got a very good relationship with the JCC. So, yeah, we're behind on getting the public report up to date. I think we're 2 years behind, maybe even 3 years behind. But
as I said, we try to make sure that folks are aware. And not just the JCC, but in terms of the town or
the respondents,
whoever is interested, to know,
hey, recently a machete case was dismissed. You might want to argue it this way or that way.
Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate your time. Yeah. As always, a pleasure.
Thanks for all your work.
Thank you. Turning to the next business of the day, we have the Ombudsman's annual update. And I see Professor Charlie Walcott, a former chair of our assembly, and Linda Foxon from the Ombudsman's office here with us. And so if you want to take center stage, we'll get you set up and recognize you for 20 minutes. You want to set up the hand of the
Sure. So we can go there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to turn on that heat lamp. Uh-oh.
The Ombudsman's office is, I think, generally poorly understood. When I became Ombudsman, the first question I got from my faculty colleagues was, "You're the Ombudsman. What's that?" And thanks to Linda and Adam Kleinberger, who is no longer with us, I can now answer that question. Basically, the Ombudsman's office is a place where you can come and talk about problems confidentially. And we don't make any decisions. What we basically do is listen to the issue that you bring to us, and we try to help you work out what activity, what way you can proceed. We've been around since 1969. We've revised our guidelines, as I think we mentioned last year, to bring them up to date, and you folks approved it, and the President approved it, and so we now are in adherence to the International Ombudsman's association code of ethics, which I'm sure is a comfort to all of you. Basically, the principles are really simple. One is, we're an independent office. That is, we're not part of HR. We report to you folks. And so that's why we're here. And you can fire us or disembowel us or whatever your pleasure is. But we report to you. We're neutral. We don't take sides in arguments. We're informal, which means we do not participate in formal processes. Happy to help folks with them, but we basically don't make decisions. All we do is try and help people get there. And finally, we're confidential, which means that we do not reveal the nature of the identity of anybody that comes to us, nor the nature of their problems. And that has two asterisks in the fine Cornell tradition. One is that if you propose harm to yourself or others, it's called imminent risk. We would feel obliged to do something about it. And secondly, if we're subpoenaed by a court of law, we don't have legal privilege, so we would have to testify. On the other hand, I point out that I am not taking any notes, and so all the court is going to get is an elderly faculty member who will say, you know, I think I remember talking to somebody about that once. So I don't think it's a very substantial danger. And the final thing we do, which I think is quite important, is by the time we have been visited by half a dozen people from the same organization reporting on disasters of one flavor or another, we tend to report upwards in the administration and say, you know, you might want to take a look at what's going on here. And we don't identify anybody. We simply bring attention to various areas that have come to our attention. And that's called upward feedback. So that's basically what we're all about. And Linda and I hold down the fort, and she's full-time at it, and I'm only half-time. So I'll turn it over to Linda to carry on.
And then the other member of our office is Helen Lang, who's the Ombudsman Office Coordinator, who handles all the administrative matters related to the office. So I think everyone has a handout, which has a front and a back, and it basically summarizes our, I think, 12 or 13 page annual report, so everyone got that, right? Mary Beth had mentioned getting questions from Jim, and we also got questions from Jim. Have all of the members seen those questions?
Yes, they have. Those are questions from the members that I forward on their behalf.
Oh, okay, sure.
And I reformat them.
Okay. So I'd like to just talk maybe just a few more minutes, answer those questions, and then dialogue with members if that seems like that would be the best use of time. So the handout, the first part of the handout summarizes what Charlie articulated in terms of how we operate following our standards. The second part of our handout is kind of a capsule summary of our annual report, talking about the number of visitors, and we did see the largest number of visitors this past year that we've ever seen. It was just up slightly from the prior year, and one of the questions that I know members brought was, well, what do we think is going to happen in the future? And, of course, this is the annual report from the past year, but we only, believe it or not, have a few more months left in 2014-15. So we counted up the number of visitors for the first semester, and it's essentially the same as last year. So we don't have a crystal ball, so we can never exactly say what our numbers are going to be in the future. But Charlie and I talked about this, and we feel that it's very likely that last year they were 2 years ago they were 380, this past year 402. Looks like we're going to be around that. I feel like under Charlie's leadership, it's not that people are having more complex problems and issues, it's that under Charlie's leadership, we're doing more outreach, making sure that this odd word ombudsman, that people actually know what we are, what we do, know who we are, so we have been going around campus, doing presentations, getting involved in resource fairs from time to time, sending out emails to the community, postering, that type of thing. So I think there's a greater awareness about the utilization of our resources. So again, I think that that's likely to be the continuing trend that will be in the 400 visitor range. And when we say 400 visitors, we count that one person comes in and they have a difficulty. We gave you a flavor of the difficulties in Section 3. Say someone is perceiving an unethical behavior or a financial malfeasance issue, or just what people have characterized about the politics, how do they navigate it. They may come visit with us once, two times, three, four, you know, but that's one visitor. So just to give you a sense of what that number is. So we provided our annual report the number of visitors, the constituency of our visitors. So we serve all constituencies, students, faculty, and staff. And the longstanding trend has been that the largest constituency is non-academic. That continues to be the case. And then we have, we don't want to be very specific because of confidentiality in terms of the incredible range of difficulties, problems, conflicts that people have, but they all fit into seven problem areas, whether it's academic, administrative, kind of business service issues, employment, human rights, which relates to some of the kind of things that you heard us talk about, interpersonal disputes, or values, ethics, and standards, which are kind of ethical issues. So all of the problems fit into that area, and again, the long-standing trend has been that employment has been the kind of number one problem area. But there's not, people come to see us, and problem areas intersect. So you might have what feels like an employment issue, a conflict with a supervisor, but there might also be a feeling of, you know, is there, you know, some type of ethical issue that someone wants to confidentially talk about, that type of thing. So there's an overlap in terms of problem areas. One of the inquiries I know was, we've given you like 10 years of data on the number of visitors, 10 years of data with respect to trends in constituency, but we didn't do that with respect to problem areas. And that's because 4 years ago, we added, and this kind of relates to just the way things are in terms of our more regulatory environment, policies, the kinds of issues that people are now coming to see us about. So we added this values, ethics, and standards, but we only had 4 years of data, and so we didn't feel like that was kind of trend data. But starting next year, we'll have 5 years, and so we'll provide that and continue to. And prior to, and it wasn't just that we added that data, we had reimagined all of the subcategories, so it wouldn't be meaningful to do it until we had a good number of years of data. But we will continue to provide that. The only other thing I want to say before I kind of open it up for questions is we, Charlie mentioned that we're independent, so we report to you. And I think it's sort of a great strength of Cornell that we don't think we're so great. I mean, that we that we have the ability to recognize that all institutions have people, and people have conflicts, and that can relate to issues in terms of productivity and at the bottom line, and that we have a safe, confidential place for people to come and speak to ombudsmen, and we're grateful to be in that role. So I'm happy to, and Charlie's happy to answer any questions if you come down and ask you all.
I'm interested in what, whether you have any intersections with or actually engage in needs dispute resolution itself, that is bringing the two parties, the parties involved down together and negotiate some kind of resolution.
So there's a, in terms of sort of the summary of what we did this past year, we put it under outreach, although it's not exactly outreach, so we've been involved in meeting with sort of people around campus who are interested in mediation and the potential to bring parties together. And it was headed by it's been headed by someone in the Scheinman Institute, and I've been helping out with this group. It's kind of to be able to offer mediation, which is even more time consuming than meeting one on one with a visitor, although it has, I believe, a great potential, and I've been trained by CDC and have been a mediator, and And Adam Heinberger, who was in our office, has been a mediator, and has a master's thesis in that. Anyway, it hasn't really taken off in our office or elsewhere, and it's really a resource issue, I would say. But we are interested in it and have talked to others about campus who are interested. Related to that is restorative justice, which isn't exactly it's related to that concept. And certainly students have been interested, particularly in that area, with respect to bias offenses. But again, there are, I think, resource constraints that are being more greatly involved in this.
I'm thinking particularly, you talked about human resource, that part of it, most of these are non-academic employees, and there are, and I feel when you help us with, not be done, but when we had interactions with it about 10 years ago, there was some discussion about this relationship, how do you get the, if there's a problem with a particular area of the university staff being treated poorly or you get lots of complaints, to actually engage human resources and be a kind of system in resolving the problem of creating a better environment for the employees, or at least representing the aggrieved employees in ways that we get the more churches than just to allow the whatever department administrator or head.
Well, I would say, Marty, that while we don't do that, what we do do is try and help the parties resolve. We will suggest that they might get some help from institutional, whatever it's called, organizational effectiveness, and so on. And but we don't do it. We just don't have the people and the time.
I was only interested in whether your department could be more than just we advise you to go to that, as opposed to yes, I understand it's a matter of resources, but if there are resources elsewhere in the university, whether it be in human relations or it be in the organizational then you could say that they are actually bring your resources as well, even though they don't get paid through your office.
Yeah. So where do we do that?
And there's cooperation on that side.
Oh, yes.
Very much.
Thank you.
And we need it. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you for coming, as always. It's a pleasure to hear from the Ombudsman's Office. You mentioned that Assistant Ombudsman Kleinberger had departed. I was just curious, how has that affected your office's ability to be operational? I know you've seen, over the past year, 2 years, a significant increase in the number of visitors. How has that affected your ability to continue to be effective as a impartial body of our campus?
Yeah, well, I think we kind of touched on that speaking to Marty, that Charlie and I feel like, all offices, which is coming about, have limited resources in the United States. So our number one primary focus is our visitors. And we say visitors because we're neutral as opposed to clients. So people who come meet with us through faculty staff is our number one priority. And to the extent that we have, other times we'd like to get involved with the other endeavors that we just mentioned. With respect to Adam Kleinberger, who departed in April and was the assistant ombudsman, he took up some of the, and was a very effective ombudsman and helped with the visitor meetings, but we no longer have his presence to take that up. I guess in 08, 09, when we had a financial crisis, that ombudsman at that time, retired, and then as was the custom, and what propelled us at the university to try to save resources was to try to not renew those positions. But we do appreciate that the university decided to keep that line, that it would be a half-time line, and so that's what Adam's position was half-time. But it really wasn't, even though he is a great ombudsman, and he's now full-time actually at the university, it was really hard be a half-time ombudsman because you're meeting with people, and then as I mentioned, there's sometimes follow-up meetings, and you're only on a half-time schedule. But even more important than that, I think, in terms of doing this work, is you have to have a real sense of kind of what's going on at Cornell in terms of the climate, the culture, just And it's really, that's really hard to do as a part-time worker. And just sort of in terms of the basics of it, it's hard to, because of our confidentiality, it's really hard to find any other job where there's not a perceived conflict of interest. Given that there's not a conflict on the face of it, if you're in another office and there's some difficulty there, people would be ready to understand that to use our resources, we can know what you can. So it's really hard to have a part-time person. So we can get that.
If I could inject, Randy, following your presentation, there is a resolution that is being brought to the floor to address this issue. It is not sponsored by the Ombudsman, so if I can ask your indulgence, maybe we can defer that discussion for just a few minutes. Other questions for the Ombudsman?
All right. I just have one more, and that is, what about intersections with student concerns? I noticed you have harassment there as one issue. Is it always, is there a possibility, what level the students come to as well?
I would say that it's a mix. We see students who are upset about grades for one reason or another and need some help in how to deal with a professor. And we kind of walk them through the process of how you might go about doing it in a way that is tactful and not likely to put the faculty's back on. That's one kind of thing. Secondly, we see a lot of graduate students who are having troubles with their major professor for one reason or another. And again, we try to be helpful. How might you get around this situation? How could you make it better? And it's kind of counseling. It's kind of offering a variety of options that they might go. Those are, I would say, the major issues that I've seen for students.
And I mean, often students, but actually all of us, sometimes, you know, whether it's in your job or other campus endeavors, you're engaged with some kind of a conflict, you can't figure out the language, you need someone who's kind of neutral and separated from it to kind of push you to figure out that language and help yourself. And I think that a lot of what goes on with students, I would add though, that a lot of students who come in for the issues that those are the issues, whether it's grades or conflict, and then when you get into a discussion, there are other issues that are related to their income with their life and that we're trying to help them with and or get them to resources that can better help them with the issues, whether it's the conflict center or other university resources.
We use up more than our allotted time, but I'd like to make one final comment in conclusion. I figure there's something like 30,000 people here in the Cornell community that we deal with, and to find only 400 cases that have come to our attention seems to me to be a remarkable tribute to the fact that most interactions around this place are civil, and that by and large, things are working pretty well. And there are, of course, some exceptions, namely the 400 people we saw. But overall, think of that as a fraction of the 30,000. So I think people ought to feel that we have a system which is really working quite well in general.
And related to that, I think that our numbers are going up, but that doesn't mean the problems are going up. I think it's more our exposure.
I wondered if you could just very quickly talk about question three, about whether you think that other faculty are best served by which assembly.
Yeah, I don't feel like we have sort of expertise per se on that. But my visceral sense is that there is would be the assembly as opposed to the faculty senate. I don't know. So you're talking about research associates or senior lecturers in which assembly would best serve their interests? Is that the question?
Well, they're employees. They're technically employees, but they seem to have a lot more in common with the non-tenure track faculty than they do with, say, the employees in the employee assembly. And so the real question is, should they have their own? Should they be pulled under the employee assembly? Should they be supported by the faculty senate or other? And I didn't know whether, I guess the genesis of this question from a member was whether, based on your experience of the cases that you see, if they felt they had some place to go vet some of their concerns, you know, larger concerns or, you know, raised issues to the university, is there an assembly that might do that and, you know, that you're kind of being a quasi, you know, quiet assembly on, essentially for a population of displaced persons?
I don't know. I think that's a tough question. When I was involved in the faculty senate, there was a year where we had a lot of discussion about non-tenure track faculty plus lecturers and so on. And I think the feeling was they were not well served by the faculty senate, nor were they well served by any other organization. And it, I don't think we really resolved the question of what to do about it. Joe probably has some perspective.
That hasn't changed very much at all. Greg and I have had conversations. Conversations earlier with the employee assembly leadership, and it never really went any good.
It gained some traction earlier this year, but yeah. Then I saw no resolutions come out of it, and I saw no fix outside of the assembly either.
Sure.
So it sounds like it's still open, maybe. Gina.
I can speak to it a little bit. The community of folks who are talking about is quite large. It's actually about 1,000 people, a little over 1,000. So we thought that is. Constituencies without representation, it should, unless you're having conversations with the folks that actually brought it to the employee assembly, and now conversations are left up to that, you know, that they currently do have representation, whether or not they choose to avail themselves of it through the EA is one thing. If we can help to create a more robust separate assembly for the, I don't know what we call them, non-professorial academics, right, then we would do that. But it still is in the conversational mode, but it is sort of with that in the body to bring forth.
Thank you.
I'm not sure. Lectures currently serve are covered by the faculty, but the faculty
depends really on the particular college, and I think almost at a departmental level, whether or not they're able to vote and things like that.
Thank you, Vice Chair. That's appropriate. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Linda, for once again joining us.
Thank you.
We are always glad to have you with us. Now we turn to the next item of the day, which is introduction of UA Resolution 5, support for the Office of the Ombudsman, so they will probably run away. But they're welcome to stay. We recognize Mr. Battaglia for 5 minutes.
Thank you. The Resolution of the Ombudsman, they play an exceptionally important role on this campus, and they actually, as also mentioned, the former assistant ombudsman, Adam Feinberger, has departed. Part of his budget, or his budget line item, has been given over to their new office coordinator, which, from speaking with the ombudsman, has enabled them to coordinate more effectively. However, the fact of the matter remains, they've seen a very large increase in visitors over the past few years. From 2012 to 2013, they saw, I believe, a 52% increase. And last year, they saw a 6% increase for an all-time record of 402 visitors, which leads to the idea that, as the ombudsman Walker clearly stated, that there are issues on this campus, and that it's an issue of outreach and having the resources to deal with them. And personally, I'm looking to provide such an enormous value to this university. I believe that it's important that we provide them not only with the support of the assembly, but as well as the financial resources to back that up. Therefore, I bring before you Resolution 5, support for the Office of the Ombudsman, which is a recommendation to the university to provide a full-time associate ombudsman position for funding. For those who don't know, the ombudsman's office is directly funded from the Office of the President, which allows their high-level independence as their outside the traditional organizational structure. And also, as Ombudsman Walcott and Linda mentioned, having a half-time ombudsman sprints problems and that you just don't have the time to resolve issues as necessary. So that combined with the fact that we've been seeing an increase in cases, our Cornell community is increasing, or increasing in size and complexity, and the level of diversity on the campus is also increasing. I believe it's important that Dan Bledsoe offers the necessary resources to be able to adequately handle cases that come, as well as be able to do the appropriate outreach so that all members of the Cornell community are aware of the service they provide.
If I can follow the Vice Chair, the Ombudsman is funded by the Office of the President, but they work for us. The way they were created, the way they institutionally came about was very much related to the University Assembly, and they have no advocate outside of the Office of the President. They're not going to ask for more staffing. Everybody's tightened their belt, as they have. The problem is a half-position assistant ombudsman isn't going to work. As soon as that person becomes really good and trained, they're going to get a full-time job someplace else. The work is available. The salary probably, you know, with benefits is, you know, a little more than $100,000, but I think they provide a lot more value to the university in what they, the conflicts they resolve and avoid than the salary. In other words, it would cost us money otherwise. Professor, or President-elect Garrett does not come from a university with an ombudsman. So I draw your attention to lines 38 to 41. And while we're advocating for a full-time assistant ombudsman, what we really want to ensure happens is that early in her tenure, she meets with them seriously to learn what they do, their value added, and put pressure on to ensure that that dialogue happens, because she's going to have a very busy first year and everybody's going to want her time. And so I would recommend and second Matthew's resolution in the sense that it's not inappropriate for this body to pressure the new president to look after somebody that is effectively works for us. Because there's nobody else who's necessarily going to bring that forward to them, and by the nature of being an ombudsman, they're not pushy people. So I think we should be consider being pushy on their behalf. This will be registered to take a vote at the next meeting, and so there's time for you to discuss it, and the formal debate will happen next time, unless there are any last-minute questions for Matthew as part of the introduction.
If I may add also, to Jim's point that President Garrett comes to the institution without an ombudsman, Cornell's ombudsman office has existed for a number of decades. We're actually we've had it for a long time. We were a driving force to introduce the institution of the office. So Cornell plays a very important role. It's also why I believe it's important that President Garrett coming to the institution doesn't have one is on top of it. It's because this assembly serves in many ways to provide a voice for those who don't have one. And the ombudsman just provides an important role on this campus, and it's the job of the assembly to advocate for them. And partially on Jim's point as well, having a full-time associate ombudsman also provides a clear line of perception. For instance, Adam was hired away to go to Boston University because he was good. But the same token, should Charlie decide to eventually step aside or Linda decide to move on or step aside as well, it provides a line of perception. Also, from sick or as I was traveling, you're not bound to one staff office where all of a sudden it's going to be exceptionally hard to juggle a caseload. So it allows for redundancy, which means that no matter what happens, we see an ombudsman's office is still able to fill the role that needs to and provide such value to the community.
Thank you, Mr. Pataglia. Return to the order today. Next up, student health fee discussion with Vice President Murphy. This is her favorite topic. She has nothing that she would rather talk about. So welcome back, Vice President Murphy. Is there anything you want us to display or put up for you? Or any handouts?
No.
Then we'd like to recognize you for 25 minutes.
Well, thank you. I apologize for not seeing the last invitation. I was trying to fly back during the snowstorm in Philadelphia and cycling stuff where I was visiting, which sadly was Florida. I also was delayed in getting in today, unfortunately. So I thank you for flexibility and schedule to allow us to continue this conversation. There's been an awful lot in the media about the health fee. Jim did send you the documents that we have posted, so I think I won't go through sort of the basics as all of your other agenda items. I do have sent a series of questions, and so I thought I might start my way through those questions. Some of them you may have found answers already if you spent time with the FAQs, but that will launch us, and I will I'll try to be brief with that so that we can have time for any additional questions or observations that you may have. So the first question that was posed is what issue or issues are driving the need to implement a student health fee for the non-student health insurance student? And there are basically two categories that I would say. One is funding. The University Health Services after the year 09-10, which was a year unlike any I returned to my 37 years in higher ed, where we had 12 student deaths, six of which came from suicide. One of those deaths was from the H1N1 epidemic that touched at least 1,500 diagnosed cases, probably 3,000 students on the campus. They were one of the largest cases of H1N1 in the United States that year. We were directed, and it was obvious, we needed to staff up to meet the health needs of the campus, both on the medical side, as well as particularly by the spring, on the psychological side. And we were directed by the president to staff as we needed to. We needed to cut back waiting times for psychological services and make sure we had the clinical staff. Fortunately, we had access to one-time funds that allowed us to respond in that year and to carry forth that investment for two more years. At the end of that time, we needed to do one of two things, either fire the staff or seek additional funding. In my judgment, it was irresponsible to let go of the staff. We had expanded our staff by 5.5 FTEs for mental health providers, by almost 3 medical clinicians, and by over 7 nurses. And it was my professional judgment together with the medical staff that for us to let that staffing go would not serve the health needs of the campus. The budget pressures were such that that funding was not provided in the ongoing allocation. One of the sources of funding the university gets is ongoing allocation. The short answer was we were given access to funding to borrow internally to sustain that level of staffing while we tried to figure out the long-term issue. We had been thinking about a health fee because that is a common practice across many institutions. One of the other major issues that Cornell has faced is that our enrollment has grown rather substantially, some planned, some unplanned, and our funding stream to health services is not driven by enrollment. And so long term, particularly with the expected enrollment in professional master's degree students, which is part of the revenue enhancement of the university, we wanted to come up with a structure that would begin to fund something like health services that, while it's not true that for every one student you add, for every 100 students you add, or certainly every 1,000 students you add, you're going to need more clinical staff to meet their needs. So a health fee, by the benefit of it being a per student charge, begins to give you that steady stream as opposed to being subject to an allocation process where it's competing priorities. So the primary issue that was driving the meeting was money. The secondary issue is that we were seeing differential access to health services. Some of that is driven by privacy issues. If you are a student on your parents' health insurance and you go to Gannett for a service and the rest will be balanced bill to your health insurance, your parents are going to know that you were there for mental health treatment, sexual health treatment, and you may or may not want to have your parents know that. And in fact, some students would actually tell us that they wouldn't do that. It was also the case that if you are on another health insurance, and we gave you examples on the FAQ, the cost of the service you get, whether you're on Cornell health insurance or on your own health insurance or your parents' health insurance, the cost is the same. One example we gave you was a sprained ankle, it's $350 is the cost. Negotiated down is all health, it's negotiated to a different level. If you're on the Cornell health insurance, that's part of your prepaid package. So you pay the $10 copay. If you're on your parents' insurance, it's going to be $240. You need to pay that out of pocket and then go seek reimbursement, which you may get or you may not get, depending upon how your health insurance. And we were seeing students choosing not to access some treatment because of that out-of-pocket expense. But by putting in the health fee, and we gave you a list again in the FAQs, things that now you have to pay out-of-pocket, if you will, are prepaid. and that we believe will provide greater access for those who need it. So funding needed and access issues. We did look at other issues. One was an allocation. That was not coming our way, and it also didn't solve our enrollment-based problem. Another was, could we directly bill the insurance company instead of giving you the bill to send the insurance company? We deal, as far as we can tell, with over 1,000 different insurance companies. And the cost for us to do that would be prohibitive. It's just not possible. I mentioned that most other institutions have health fees. We're a combination of fee-for-service allocation and health fee. The $350 was determined, which is another question, in consultation with students. We knew it was about a $300 to $350 range, depending upon how we structured it. One option could have been structured on paying a percentage of the cost. Another was the flat $10 copay. And we ultimately decided, having talked with a series of focus groups of students, that the flat copay was more predictable. You know, for students, it's what our students on the health insurance pay. And if I'm a student one way or the other, I know if I'm going to go in, I have $10 copay. It's not $10 debate or 10%, depending upon what ultimately I'm determined to need with the visit and the x-ray and the like. Another question that you asked, these are probably long, but I may come back to the others if I don't cover them. The fee has generated a significant response for students. One of the students' main complaints and concerns. I think that I would categorize them in several ways. There are concerns about the cost. And for some students, that $350 is a significant concern. For some of their parents, and I happen to have heard from one parent who's got three kids here. So that's going to add $1,000. That's a significant concern that was unplanned. I think the second large category was the lack of involvement in the determination of would we have a fee or not. The students feeling left out of the decision-making process and concerned about the transparency of the university around our expenses. And so both of those issues, the health fee per se and what I would say is more concern around the transparency of finances. I presented the student assembly, President Scorton had a group of students in the office with whom we talked for about an hour. He and I met with a group of the concerned students. I talked with the student assembly leadership. President Scorton, as I think may have been announced today or maybe it's coming tomorrow, will be doing an open forum for the campus about the finances of the university that will be on Monday the 15th from 12 to 1. To whom faculty staff students are welcome. I can't tell you where it's located. I'm going to say it may be on the calendar, but I don't know. I don't know whether, Joe, you know where. Where are they holding the forum?
G1.
G1 Europe?
No,
G10 Biotech. As a result of that, I will be going to vet school right after spring break, and I'm trying to work with the law school the day of after the session. What I've tried to say to students, and being as honest as I can, I don't see the fee going away. What we can learn about the transparency process, how we can make it more understandable, I will talk as long as I need to. But the issue is the fee. If the fee is going to be talked away, I don't believe that's going to happen. We've also been answering many emails and trying to make more information transparent through the Caring Community website in addressing the concerns. One of the questions from one of the GPSA members is one of the goals is to make it more equitable and ensure financial concerns no longer prevent students from seeking health care. How will we know we've reached that goal? We will continue to track the usage of health services. We can do that, frankly, better at the undergraduate level because of the way we have access to financial aid information. for most of our graduate students, actually, most of them, if they are in a research master's or a research PhD, they are already in Cornell Health Insurance. It's part of what the package is. As I think we've explained in the comments, we anticipate this will affect about 10% of the graduate students, about 30% of the professional students, and about 70% of the undergraduates, because so many of the undergraduates are still under parent health insurance. How will we know this? Will this fee adjust over time, that the demands needed will adjust over time? Our intent is to create a healthy advisory committee, very much similar to our student insurance advisory committee. We've had a standing student insurance advisory committee that has students, faculty, and staff on it for years, yet ultimately makes recommendations to Vice President Stefano, Vice President of Finance, and me, and we either accept them or reject them. Our intent would be to create a healthy advisory committee. One of the things we found very helpful in the student insurance advisory committee is trying to balance many interests and demands and wants and to monitor what we're seeing. So if students want greater dental care and greater vision care, well, that will come with a cost. Are there savings elsewhere in the student insurance plan? That's the kind of competition that goes on all the time in the student insurance advisory committee. We would have imagined trying to do the same thing in the health advisory committee. I think one of the greatest pressures we feel is to increase our hours of service. The staff is trying very hard to do that now. It already is open on a walk-in basis Monday through Thursday until 7 o'clock, particularly in the counseling and psych services. We're trying to see if we can't staff to do that for scheduled appointments. Similarly, Gannett is open on Saturdays. We're trying to see if we can't figure out how to staff for some on Sundays. Right now, without increasing beyond the fee we've already put in place. But I can imagine over time, those would be issues that would be examples that we would be talking about in healthy advisory committee. So let me stop there with trying to go through a number of the questions. Gina, if you're pouring water, I would love to. I help myself, but I'm not as mobile as I once was. Thank you. I hope to be again. So let me listen to your comments, address additional questions.
Members? Mr. Battaglia?
Thank you for coming, Vicki Murphy. I know your schedule is exceptionally busy, and I know we've spoken before about some of the concerns I've had and I've heard from students. But looking forward, I know you mentioned there's talk about transparency and looking at how we can change in the future. I was just wondering, how is your outlook on breaking fee increases and tuition increases to students change from this? I know you mentioned that you're going around talking to all the assemblies. You're looking to create a committee to talk about the health fee. But what else in the future, when another fee inevitably comes to bear, how is the experience with this, how is that affecting how the administration is going to try and include students and be more transparent on future issues?
I can't speak for either my professor or President Garrett. The style, I don't know, quite frankly. As we've not had in the time of mostly undergraduate, a housing and dining increase. But as an example, there is a residential and community committee in the SA and a dining committee. And in the past, when we've been faced with some pressures around fees, housing increases, and dining increases, we've tried to use those committees to let them know what are the pressures we are facing and how we're trying to grapple with them. I don't know what mechanism President Garrett will want to put in place for including students in the setting of tuition. I think historically we used to hold presentations about what we were anticipating for tuition increases in the November, early December time period, particularly back in the days when the amount of work, I've been here long enough to have lived through many different iterations, but back in the days when the amount of money you might have to borrow or work as an undergraduate, therefore your self-help, whether that would grow or not, was related to what was happening with the tuition increase. When that was happening, we would have meetings for the SA and whole forums about what was driving the tuition increase and what we were thinking about with self-help before we ultimately sent that to the board. My recommendation would be to try to find ways to have some of those discussions in the fall. something like tuition, as an example, is a very complicated problem. It involves priorities in the academic area. It involves HR practices around staff. It involves union contracts that you have. It involves investment in programs. So there are many, many pieces coming at the quote central administration or the budget office before finally a recommendation. I think the challenge is, are there ways that students can be involved in that input process? I don't anticipate, and again, this is just even with the honest view of the world, I don't envision a veto that would exist where you would put up, the proposed increase up to a vote, the SA or the GPFA, and then you would approve, and would that affect the ultimate outcome other than represent the opinion. But I think there are ways to bring folks to bear as the pressures are being concerned around the salary and the benefit increase for staff, the investment in student programs, the need to address our hundreds of millions of dollars of deferred maintenance.
Thank you.
Other questions?
One behind you.
Mr. Friedman?
You mentioned issues regarding the presentation of the information. I guess to offer some context for that, I know that the student assembly suffered a huge crisis in legitimacy because there was, not now in the public record, there's documentation of suppression of information that students had. They were told not to share information that they learned about in private meetings, such as where exactly the health team was going. These emails were clearly not written by the students to the students, right? Because the students referred to themselves in the third person and by title, which I don't know any other undergrad that would ever do that. Things like that really worry a lot of undergrads about the shared governance process, right? One of the things that I've learned in SA is there's a lot of really good rhetoric you can do where you can turn any problem into a solution. You can frame it that way. But in the information that came out about the health fee, none of it was about the problem that actually caused it. None of it was about the majority of where the money was going. And in fact, Courtney was quoted in the Sun as saying, I have no intention to bullshit, but like, the information clearly wasn't coinciding on that front, right? Because the whole pitch was students
have
a lower copay. I guess I'm concerned about that. I wonder if those issues could be explicitly dealt with. I've seen them sidestepped a lot in a lot of these conversations, and I'm hoping that it can be addressed. The legitimacy of the BSA can be about.
So let me address the particular, and then I'll try to make the more general. So of the $350 health fee, $200 of it is going to solve our existing funding shortfall, a gap that started in 9-10 that was one-time funded and is growing to 1,000 and growing. And within that $200, some of it is that we pay back the loan we had to take out to cover that. About $70 of the $200. $150 is to increase the access. The things that now people pay for as they go for a fee for service will be part of the prepay. So that's to be as explicit as I can be. In retrospect, and I think I said this to the student assembly, we made a wrong decision. When we were talking with a number of folks about how to roll out what the health fee would be. We had a lot of the detailed information you have come to see after the fact, and we had a more general presentation. A number of folks were inclined to go with the detail. Many thought that was too detailed to go with more general. In retrospect, we made the wrong choice. And I, as a responsible executive, I can take responsibility for that. Completely discussed those alternatives and made a choice with the wrong choice. So the other issue, and this is a more, and I can't speak to the email, so I don't know where it came from, so I just can't help you on that. To the issue of when we are seeking input before we go public with something, do we put our elected representatives in an untenable position when we ask them to participate but don't ask them to advance it before it's ready for prime time? I think that's a legitimate question that we as a community have to talk about. Because I'm sympathetic to how the students have felt as a result of that. That was not our intent at all. Our intent was to try to work with the governance system. but we weren't ready for it to be rolled out while we were still trying to figure out is it a percentage of the dollar and how are we going to go with the tail or are we going to go with the general. And so, yes, at that time, we were asked them not to be the purveyors of the information to the community. Once the community had it, I don't think they had any concern about what they knew or what they didn't know. But if asking our elected officials, or student elected officials, to participate in those a priori consultations is a compromise, then we need to understand where else we'll go to get the student's input and what does that do to the governance process. But to me, that's a very legitimate campus conversation for us to have. We have done both. We do both. So,
what I'm saying is somebody that's faculty, an issue that the faculty is not unusual for elected officials to ask the faculty to be heard
something before they're asked.
Yep. And to be honest, I think that's been done. I mean, we elect them feeling to some degree of confidence in their ability to judge how it's presented by the administration. And that's their job, is to listen and provide feedback and wait. I would not want to do that. It's just me.
If I might, in response to that, I looked on the Caring Community site, and there still isn't information about that 200 versus 150. It's still all framed as increasing access.
Okay.
Other questions, comments? Thank you, Vice President Murphy, for joining us.
Thank you all very much.
We appreciate your time and your candor. Thank you. Next business of the day is for vote, UA Resolution 4, providing for faculty advisor to the Office of the Judicial Closed Counselor. Bring it up,
of course.
We'll recognize Mr. Battaglia when he is ready. Do we need to turn on an overhead lamp? Or am I the only one who's... a copy of UAR4 was in the members' packages. And read it.
As you can hear a lot from you today, but... before you again, as you read Resolution 4, it was briefly introduced at last meeting from the ACP provided there in the report. ACP Medic is here, so I made it for referring to the more detailed questions. I did collaborate throughout this resolution. For those who are new in the audience and those who weren't here last time, I'll go over it again briefly. As it stands right now, the Judicial Code Council is an office staffed entirely by law students who are still matriculated law students. They're not practicing attorneys, and they turn over every number of years as they graduate. And this is at the beginning of the meeting. So we have to be at the university is in the process of appointing a new one for next year. This resolution is to provide for a faculty advisor to that office. In the past, their office currently operates independently. But while the law school has been supportive of this, as well as the new JCC themselves, nothing's really done. So this is almost an unthinking kind of bringing the relevant authorities to make sure it actually occurs. In terms of concerns last time, we decided to keep the word advisor, and after speaking with Amanda, that was a concern raised by Richard, that we're referring to this in the colloquial term as an advisor, in that they're just advising, and not the academic term of advisor actually has jurisdiction. We decided that after looking at the past practice and what the office does, and even what the code physically reads, it's clear enough that advisor is the correct term, and that adding a different term may just sort of confuse matters. And finally, in regard to Ron Booker's point, we added actually a clause, I believe it's line 35 to 41, which provides or extends the umbrella of confidentiality on matters worked on with the faculty advisor, with the client's permission to the faculty advisor when they're able to participate in confidential discussions. And I believe that was all the changes. I'm just open to questions.
Questions? Hearing none, the matter has been is properly before you for a vote. Are there any last comments or questions before we call the question? Seeing none, Then, all in favor of UA Resolution 4 as presented, please raise your placard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I count 13. Do you have the same count? Any against? I see none. Abstentions? The resolution carries 13-0-0. Thank you, Mr. Battaglia. I will forward it to the Office of the President tomorrow. Latest addition to the agenda, UA Resolution 7, introduction of Resolution 7, calling for implementation of an open course evaluation system, sponsored by Mr. Battaglia on behalf of Mr. Fridman. Both are present. Mr. Battaglia, the floor recognizes you for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman Blair. I will let Joseph speak for a good chunk of this because actually I work with him as one of the riot force to the student assembly. We can collaborate with him, but I'm helping him because in essence, this work, the open course evaluation system was passed by the student assembly and it got a little bit stuck up in the administration. It was deferred to the provost, to the acting provost, who then met with Joseph and eventually ended up deferring back to the student assembly, asking for the student assembly to reach out individually to all the various colleges and academic units to attempt to see how open course evaluation can be influenced in Cornell. And that's something that the student assembly has a hard time coming up with the resources for. Additionally, they don't have the authority to actually make encourage strongly academic groups and colleges to cooperate in a way that is constructive. So therefore, we decided to bring it forward to this assembly for more feedback and writing. And I'm sure Joseph can talk exactly about the exact details of what we're going to do.
I was actually able to we just presented to the chairs of the Arts and Sciences College. But that's a process that's going to be hard to do college by college, plus that's going to lead to a lot of piecemeal distribution of things like sites where you can get syllabi or you can get evaluations. So really, all that we're contending is that this is a subject worth talking about, right? In the status quo, tuition is going to hit $100,000 in the next decade. Yes, choosing classes is a shot in the dark. All you get is a title, a professor, and 5 sentences. Of course, you can email, you can try to do something during shopping period. On the other side of that, though, are huge biases in email response. If you're an Asian American woman, you're 30% less likely than a white male to get a response from a professor at any given point in time based on Wharton studies, all sorts of effects like that. We think that students should be able to pursue any person, any study, regardless of their social network, regardless of their advisor. We think advisors should have access to information about courses. At the very least, syllabi should be up, so students can have some reduction in entropy for what they can consider a course to be, and at best, they will have guidance from other students. There are a lot of issues to be considered. We can talk about them, but the intention is at least this should be considered university-wide.
I think it's also that the resolution specifically is calling for the provost to constitute an open course evaluation working group with members from all relevant colleges and academic units, containing at least two members of the SA and GCSA to further discuss this, because there are having valid concerns raised. But it seems like just deferring it off and leaving, in some ways, the discussion to flounder a little bit, it doesn't do anyone justice, and it doesn't allow for positive progress to make in terms of how we can better evolve course selection for the student body and the community body.
As you can see in the whereas clause, CHILD has this, engineering has this, all of our IB plus peers that also have, health fees have them. So if we can have health fees, I think we can also have those.
I remind you, members, this is just for introduction. You'll be able to think about a debate would be scheduled for the next meeting where we would intend to vote. The resolve asking the provost to create a working group, resolve that there would be SA and GPSA representatives, and resolve that they would report back by January 31st of 2016. So one of the things they didn't, one of the problems with the previous response to Student Assembly Resolution 29 asking the student assembly to go college by colleges, year by year the SA changes over, just like we do. Continuity of the SA and focus and everything else is just hard to maintain. There it is.
Sir, this has, as Joseph knows, gone before the Faculty Education Policy Committee, and it's still under discussion at some level, but it has not gone anywhere really. Most of the faculty feel that this is faculty prerogative, whether or not there should be a course question and evaluations. and that it probably should be done college by college. That was our advice to Joseph.
Thank you. Other comments or questions?
Are still going on.
Would I be able to respond? Yes, so I requested that we vote or talk about a resolution. That request hasn't been granted for months. Now, I sit on that committee with Dean Burns. I would say that committee has had the same, that committee meets for an hour about every 2 to 3 weeks, and there's usually about 20 minutes of discussion, most of which is on topics we've already covered about it, such as like open comments and things like that, and it has very little to do with the idea that this should be brought up university-wide. It's mostly about critiquing the individual points. So I definitely take that point, but I also think to say that it's in flux and under serious consideration might be an exaggeration.
But the other issue that needs to be, how about shared governance? As soon as you try to do this centrally, you're going to get some stuff in the community. Each individual college has their sort of way of doing things. So if you're not careful in terms of crafting an approach that actually specifically targets, let's say, the largest units, IT sciences, you may find that you're actually going to have less support. So they're just like students, they don't have to be like top down support resources. But on the other hand, if you talk to the Arkansas students and the chairs and follow up within 1 year, you may actually have more
support. We should have syllabi actually in Arkansas in fact fall. We should have some conversation about evaluation going through. It's just I imagine kind of the main student proponent behind this. I imagine that after I'm no longer in the state, it won't keep going. So it would be easy to ask the working group to have the kind of representation in each college because they do things differently. And that kind of issue.
The resolution also acknowledges that there are hurdles, but if this would be a large undertaking, nothing is done. I mean, nothing that Cornell has done exceptionally quickly, especially when it comes to a large issue. It's just an access to the desire to keep the conversation going and not allow it to falter on the basis of a few concerns. I mean, even physically, they did every college something differently. It would be relatively easy because looking at, say, going off Yale with Blue Book, which is a fairly good example, every course has a standardized, I think, 6 or 7 multiple choice questions. It's just, would you rate this easier or harder than other courses or taking it for your major? Things that are really general and that can apply to almost any course. And that can be managed at entry level with every unit is going to solve their own online or paper evaluation of professors.
And that's how you get a department evaluation and a general
evaluation. Yeah. So there are solutions, but they'll just have merit discussion.
Professor Hatch.
I noticed in here there's nothing about the campus faculty advising system. And my experience is already decades old. But faculty advisor for me in college is a really essential and crucial. And freshman year, of course, you talk about everything in college. Mm-hmm. In a couple of years, you begin to talk with your advisor in the department. And they have a feel for certain courses, and they could have it with that. So, I mean, as far as the inference is concerned, it's interesting. Sure, a lot has to do with how a college decides to organize its evaluation courses, but really what's crucial in terms of the student is not that they read a bunch of stuff about what other people think about the course, but how they can interact with somebody in a faculty position who can help them think about what it is they're reading. And how it fits into their broader idea of what they want to do when they leave. And I guess I feel like, I don't know, I'm sure you discussed this somewhere in these departments, but I know that there's been a decline of faculty advising, a significant decline, and mostly it has to do with the key emphasis of it as important to progress through the university as a faculty member from assistant professorship or lectureship up through. And I think that's a major fault.
I think it's a very unfortunate occurrence. And it's a two-way street, though. I think that the students are equally liable for not taking advantage. I mean, I sit in my office forever, and I get people coming in just before the prelims.
Well, I understand that. I agree. I mean, there's an orientation problem. But there's also, I felt the same way at some point in my 30 years of doing this, but it's also a decline in the understanding of how students and faculty should interact when students come. And I guess I'd like to say that there really has to be a kind of discussion of the overall organization and how these things fit in, rather than trying to, you know, grab at a symptom and say, oh, this will be the answer, course evaluation. When we all know that, you know, course evaluation can be as rancid as anything else. So anyway, I suggest that the faculty is curious to think about this and talk about recalibrating the idea of what constitutes successful faculty, you know, delivery in the university.
And may I add, I think any course evaluation, one of the questions is, it 14 year hard? I mean, that one should be taken. Hopefully, no grades should be, average grade should be included in that. Because we all know what happened, the median grade is what happened. And then you have a number of courses that historically have given lots of A's, and all of a sudden, you're going to have students who question why they got a C, because they came up with a piece of paper and said, everyone gets an A. Even if they didn't work. Because that's how she brings to the top. They thought the historical records represent what they needed to do in order to get ahead. Everyone gets an A, and I think it's not that she would not. So I would hope that she would include medium grade or a support PGR. But easy course to me to do, difficult course to me.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. We will have a formal debate on this before a vote next meeting. I remind you, at our next meeting, March 24th, we have President Skorton, his final address to the Assembly. We also have Dr. Wolf and Leslie Schill, the campus planner, coming. That's when we find out whether our parking fees are going to go up next year, among other things. And introduction of the divestment resolution and some other things. So with that, it is 6:11, and unless there are objections? Already done.
Oh, you did?
Yes, and I'll be invite you to stay afterwards, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you have. It is 6:12. We are adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.